Good afternoon, and welcome to the Early Life Exposures Long-Term Health Consequences Internet Web Subinar Series. This is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. This is the first session entitled Polybrominated Diphenyl Ethers, Exposures, and Toxicity. I'm Bill Sook, Director of the Superfund Research Program here at NIEHS, and I will be the moderator for today's session. We will get started in a few minutes, but while we're waiting for others to log on, I'm going to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot-linked on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have question and answer sessions at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or by using your phone's mute button. Okay. Once again, *6 to mute, *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. And also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and be on slide one. As all of those participating via the internet should have clicked on the, quote, go to session, end quote, icon near the bottom of the page, and should be on slide one of the presentation. As explained on slide two, okay, there you go, slide two, the main page contains the slides which, above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the, quote, question mark, end quote, icon you see above the slide. And you need not wait until the question and answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance the question and answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a phone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so that you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are on the ClueIn website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information or ClueIn archives. With that, we are ready to start this session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute. And again, do not put us on hold. To start off this webinar series, we are privileged to hear from Dr. Linda Birnbaum, the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Linda is not only the director of this institute, but she's also the director of the National Toxicology Program. She's a board-certified toxicologist, having served as a federal scientist for over 31 years. Dr. Birnbaum has received many awards and recognitions, including being elected into the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. She is also a fellow of the Collegium Ramazzini. Dr. Birnbaum is the author of more than 700 peer-reviewed publications, book chapters, abstracts, and reports. She's an adjunct professor in the Gilling School of Global Public Health, Curricular Toxicology in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, as well as engaged in the Integrated Toxicology Program at Duke University. Linda is a native of New Jersey, received her MS and PhD in microbiology from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So with that, I will turn this over to Dr. Birnbaum. You are now on slide 3.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. It's a pleasure to provide some introductory remarks for this Risky Learning web seminar series on early life exposures and long-term health consequences. I'm going to be going over the basis behind environmental effects on development and health, especially exposures in early development. Now, if we can go to slide 4, and I've got to move them just like all of you. We know that there are different stages of development from the first week of the embryo to the postnatal years, not only through puberty, but we're beginning to understand that at least with the nervous system, development can extend at least as long as 25 years of age. The standard biomedical paradigm has been that exposures during development will affect the organ system in question. And I think one of the key points that I'm going to bring up and bring up repeatedly is that there are windows of susceptibility. And the window of susceptibility for one organ system may not be the same as another organ system. And that even within a given organ system, different tissues and different parts of that system may be developing at different points in time. So I think that's something that we always have to keep in mind, that when exposures occur, are going to have different effects. So if we go to slide 5, on this slide, a clear issue is that if you have susceptibility during development, you can have many effects that occur throughout throughout life. So while this slide looks at effects that, for example, or exposures that might predominate during gestation, leading to effects that might not become visible. Some of them may not even become visible until later life, and many will be visible at childhood or puberty at other stages. I think it's also important to stress that, just like I said, that there are different windows of susceptibility. They're not just gestational, but in fact, there are windows during childhood that can affect later stages. Puberty is an extremely time for susceptibility. I mean, I think we can step back and say any time where there's a lot of cell differentiation and proliferation is going to be a time susceptibility. The reproductive life, especially, for example, for a woman during pregnancy, is a major susceptibility window, as well as other times during life, and we need to remember that. I think our understanding of the whole developmental origins of disease, often called, if it's focusing on gestational susceptibility, FEBAD, the fetal basis of adult disease, I think it's important that our growing understanding of the phenomenon of epigenetics allows us to understand how exposure at one point in life can lead to altered responsiveness, which is not evident often until much later in life. So those would be clear points we need to keep in mind. Go on to slide 6. In this slide, we're looking at all the different diseases which are clearly now shown to be the result of developmental exposures. So, for example, we know that many kinds of learning differences in behavior can be the result of early life exposure. Asthma, we know that based upon exposures that occur, for example, if a mother smokes while she's pregnant, if the child has a certain glutathione S transferase polymorphism, that child is going to be extremely susceptible to asthma later on. There's growing evidence for certain male effects, such as cryptorchidism, hypophosphatasia, and testicular cancer, as well as infertility, may be associated with early life exposure to estrogenic compounds. We know that changes, for example, some recent data is indicating that fibroid tumors may be related to early life exposure to soy or possibly diabetes. And, for example, many other things, we're beginning to believe that early life may predispose to many different things, including cardiovascular disease or breast cancer or even Alzheimer's disease later on. I'm going to go to the next slide. I want to now switch to start talking about the title of this whole series of webinars, which is going to be on some of the flame retardants. And I think many of you may know that this has been a major area of interest for me probably for the last 10 years or so. Where I became very concerned about the potential for the brominated flame retardants to impact our health, and especially the potential impact on development. So we know that, for example, the PBDEs, which were one of the major classes of flame retardants, we found them in breast milk. There's evidence, and I think Dr. Stapleton's going to talk about the thyroid hormone disruption, and Dr. Cotavante is going to talk about some of the developmental neurotoxicity. I think most of the brominated flame retardants, certainly the PBDEs and some of the others, the reason that we have such high levels of environmental exposure is not only the large volumes of use, which I'm going to talk about, but the fact that these are additive flame retardants. They don't bind chemically to the matrix, and therefore they leach out and can get into the environment and from the environment into all of us. So if we go to slide 8, we can now talk about where the halogenated flame retardants are used. We're going to focus these discussions on the brominated flame retardants, but there's growing evidence of a concern of some of the chlorinated fire retardants as well. So in the U.S., they have been primarily used for electronics, building insulation, polyurethane foam, and wire and cable. There is a reactive flame retardant, brominated flame retardant, that is used heavily in electronics. It's called TBBPA. So that has not achieved as high environmental levels because it tends to stay put to a bigger extent. Polyurethane foam, at some points in time, could be as much as 25 to 30% by weight of PBDEs. We go to slide 9, just a little bit on what some of the health effects in both in animals and humans that have been reported. There's evidence that, and again, I'm focusing on developmental exposures, that prenatal BDE49 is one of the major PBDE congeners that is in the products. I should mention that PBDEs are very similar in structure to PCBs And just like there were at least theoretically 209 different PCBs, there are 209 theoretical PBDEs, and the different ones may have different, not only physical, chemical, but biological effects. But in the major PBDE commercial product that was used in polyurethane foam, the major congener was something called PBDE-99. And the numbers here just reflect the same kind of numbering system that's used for the PCBs. If we used PBDE-47, which is the major congener that is found in most biota and wildlife and people, while it's not the major one in the polyurethane foam product, in fact, it is the major one in people. And we found that that altered rat body weights if exposure was from birth through puberty. Other studies looking at exposing infantile mice at postnatal day 10 showed to, again, to this major one in human blood, the BDE-47, led to increased body weights once they became, once they went through puberty. And then there's also some evidence, for example, to use a non-mammalian species that developing shrimp exposed to this congener had increased cholesterol levels as well, possibly a reason for increased weight. If we go now to slide 10, this is just a very brief summary of some of the effects that have been reported from human epidemiology studies, and I don't have all the recent studies from the last couple of months on here. Prior, there were no human studies of the PBDEs. The first one was reported by Christine Main from Denmark in 2007, where she reported an association of higher maternal PBDE levels with the little boy's cryptorchidism. Then there's a number of effects on reproductive hormones. John Meeker's reported decreases in androgens and LH and increases in FSH and inhibin. Almost all these studies are associated with mom's levels. And since the PBDEs tend to be bioaccumulative and persistent, measuring mom's level at one point during pregnancy is a good reflection of what her exposure would have been throughout pregnancy. And again, reproductive effects, in the Chamakos cohort, Brenda Eskenazi and colleagues have reported effects on low birth weight and behavioral effects and increased time to pregnancy as well. There's also some evidence of neurological effects and some cognitive effects. Effects, again, on sperm quality have been reported. Appears to be maybe associated with increased diabetes. Mary Turek's studies of Great Lakes fish eaters suggested that in those subjects who are hypothyroid appeared to be have an increase in type 2 diabetes. And then there is a growing list of papers showing that PBDEs may alter thyroid homeostasis in the offspring associated with prenatal exposure. I should say that the thyroid data, and I think when Dr. Stapleton talks about the thyroid issue, is extremely complicated. There are differences, or not everything appears to be tied up with a neat bow and make a nice story between not only all the human cohorts, but also with the animal cohorts as well. If we go to the next slide, number 11, this is just showing what's been happening out there as far as the levels of PBDEs in the North American environment in our different species. And what you can see is that basically, while the levels in blood have been continuing to increase, the levels in a lot of the critters is also increasing as well. Now, there's actually some very recent data suggesting that since the sole U.S. manufacturer of the PBDE product that was used in polyurethane foam stopped producing it at the end of 2004, we are now beginning to see some decrease, at least in human levels, but this is not necessarily reflected in some of the wildlife. If we go to the next slide, number 12. If you want to know who has the highest PBDE levels, Well, first of all, I should mention that the general population studies, if you live in North America, you have levels that are on average about 10 times higher than the levels in Europe or Asia, and that's because we use this PVDE product in polyurethane foam, and it was not used in Europe or Asia to any significant extent. However, if you look in other parts of the world, what you can find is that the people who have the highest PVDE levels, and many of these are much higher than we see on average in the American population, what you see is that people who are working at in recycling of e-waste tend to have incredibly high levels of the PVDEs. And we're also finding that the levels in children may be higher than parents, and there is some data that supports children's high exposure as well in this country. And so there was a study that came out of Managua, Nicaragua, children who are actually living and working at waste disposal sites had extremely elevated levels as well. Now, most of the time I've been focusing on the PVDEs that were used in foam products. However, there is another major PVDE called PVDE-209, which is the fully brominated congener, and its levels are reported in the pale yellow bars. Until recently, this was frequently not measured when people were doing human studies because there were a lot of technical difficulties and a huge amount of background contamination. But we're now beginning to find PVDEs a little bit different than some of the other PVDEs. It has a shorter half-life in people. It appears to be broken down with a half-life of on the order of weeks instead of years. And we are beginning to find people with elevated levels in this country and elsewhere. And while that has been banned in Europe, it will be withdrawn from production in the U.S. next year. We go to the next slide, which is number 13. How are we exposed to flame retardants? I can tell you that in about 2003, 2004, I was convinced that PVDEs were going to be like any of the other persistent organic pollutants, like the dioxins or the PCBs or stuff, and the major exposure would be from the food that we eat. In our country, with the high use of these products, of these compounds in products in commerce and our consumer products, in fact, the major source of exposure is not food, but is actually related to indoor exposure and largely the ingestion of dust particles, which gets on our food and is on our hands and so on and gets into our bodies. There is clearly some exposure from food, but it is actually much less than the exposure from ingestion of household and office dust. Now, if we go to slide 14, this is just a little bit on some of the regulations that for the PVDEs. These chemicals are all have been in production since the early 70s, so that there was never any requirement in the U.S. that they really be tested for anything. The first report of PVDEs in breast milk came from the Swedes in 2000 and was a wake-up call because of the increasing levels of this, first detected really in the late 70s to the early 80s. In 2004, as I already mentioned, the sole U.S. manufacturer stopped production, but in the European Union, they actually banned the two commercial products, the Penta and the Octa products, which had some of the lower brominated congeners in them. The Penta was the product that was used extensively in foam. In 2008, the European Union banned the BD-209 or the DECA product, and quite a number of states have actually banned all three of these. The U.S. manufacturers have agreed to stop production of DECA by 2013. And I think one of the questions that we should be asking is, if we're not using the Penta and the Octa, soon the DECA, what next? And there is certainly some concern about the products. So some of the other VFRs that are used, I mentioned TBBPA, which is actually and has always been the largest volume of the brominated flame retardants, used heavily in electronic equipment and is completely unregulated, and there is a growing body of data which suggests that it may not be entirely innocuous. Hexabromocyclododecane, abbreviated HBCD, is a non-aromatic brominated flame retardant that has been banned in the EU and Norway. It has been nominated as a substance of very high concern to the Stockholm Convention and has actually now been added to the Stockholm Convention as a POP. PBDEs, again, were targeted for elimination and added to the Stockholm Convention, the penta and the octa in 2009, and again, as I've mentioned already, that the fully brominated one, the U.S. is phasing it out by 2013. If we go to slide 16, this is some of the concern about the huge increase that has occurred in Asia in the use of all the brominated flame retardants. What you can see, the red bars here are the use of brominated flame retardants, and what you can see that Asia is using many, many more hundreds of thousands of metric tons of the brominated flame retardants than are used in the U.S. or in Europe. The major class of flame retardants that are actually being used in the U.S. are some of the aluminum hydroxides, which are shown in kind of the dark turquoise bar. And if you look at the light turquoise bar, what you see there, those are the organophosphates, and I think that's something we should be paying attention to about the potential adverse effects that some of the organophosphate flame retardants may have. I would mention that the flame retardants that were banned from kids' pajamas in the late 1970s because of their high mutagenic and animal carcinogenic data, some of them are being repurposed and are currently being used, for example, in polyurethane foam products. And if we go to slide 17, I think that I'm done. Thank you all for listening. Two more. Took a while for that one to come up. Slide 18. Let's go back to 17. Did not seem took a while to come up. Back to 17. So what do we want to think about when we think about alternatives to flame retardants? There are other classes as shown on the last slide with the different classes of flame retardants. We certainly want to minimize the potential for hazard and exposure. We'd like chemicals that don't persist in the environment and don't bioaccumulate, and that should be not only the parent chemical but the breakdown product. We'd like them to be a very low, if not non-toxic, so there's less potential for harm if exposure occurs. And we'd like to have low potential for release from the product. As I mentioned, much better to use an additive kind of flame retardant than just something, a reactive flame retardant, much better than an additive. And if we go to the last slide, some of the other considerations, and these are manufacturer's considerations. I can tell you I went and looked at actually to a furniture factory, and they did not like foam that wasn't bright white. They didn't want foam that turned yellow, which was one of the problems with some of the alternative flame retardants. Another issue is fire safety here, although I will tell you that many of the chemical flame retardants, especially the brominated ones, really contribute very little to increase fire safety despite the claims of the manufacturers. There are issues that the manufacturers have to look at with the process costs. They are developing alternative technologies such as barriers and some surface treatment. And I think the major consideration needs that we need to minimize risk to human health and to the environment. So with that, I think I am done. Thank you all.
Thanks a lot, Linda. Appreciate your participating in this this webinar. I think we're going to go ahead and move on. Our next presentation today is Superfund Research Program researcher Dr. Heather Stapleton. Dr. Stapleton is Assistant Professor of Environmental Chemistry at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke. Dr. Stapleton received her PhD in environmental chemistry from the University of Maryland at College Park in 2003. From 2003 to 2005, she was a postdoctoral research associate at the National Institute of Standards and Technologies in the Analytical Chemistry Division. And in September of 2005, she accepted a position as assistant professor in the Nicholas School of the Environment. In 2008, she was awarded with an Outstanding New Environmental Scientist Award, ONES, from the from NIEHS, for her research grant entitled Children's Exposure to Brominated Flame Retardants, Effects on Thyroid Hormone Regulation. Dr. Stapleton's research program examines the source, fate, transport, and metabolism of halogenated organic contaminants in the environment. Her current research projects focus on human exposure to flame retardant chemicals, particularly in children, and identification of flame retardant chemicals in consumer products. She also has active research programs that examine species-specific differences in the metabolism of flame retardant chemicals and impacts of halogenated contaminants on thyroid hormone regulation. Analytical methods employed in Dr. Stapleton's laboratory include gas chromatography, liquid chromatography, and mass spectrometry. So thank you. So Heather, you're up.
Okay, thank you for that very nice introduction. Hopefully everyone can hear me. I just picked up my phone. I think I'll try to talk through the receiver. And for anyone joining late, I'm going to be starting on slide 21, which is my title slide. And as Dr. Sook just said, I'm going to be speaking today about some of the research that we've been conducting in my laboratory looking at exposure to flame retardant chemicals. And today I'll talk primarily about PBDEs during early development, some impacts on thyroid hormone regulation. So moving to slide 22, this is just a quick outline. I do have some background information in my presentation here that I might run through quickly as Dr. Birnbaum has covered many of these points and try to get more to the meat of my presentation, which is really kind of a discussion of two research studies that we conducted, one looking at PBDEs in a cohort of pregnant women and looking at associations with thyroid hormone levels during pregnancy and birth outcomes. And a second study looking at toddlers' exposures to PBDEs in the indoor environment and really trying to focus more on identifying the most significant exposure pathways and trying to determine whether exposure and body burdens are associated with socioeconomic status. And then I'll try to end by linking it to some of the observations with thyroid hormone adverse effects related to thyroid hormone regulation in animal studies and other human studies and some problems that have been noted in children with higher exposure to these compounds. So moving to slide 23, this is just quickly some background for anyone interested in how we technically define a flame retardant. It's a substance added or treatment applied to material to reduce or delay the combustion of that material. And certainly fire safety is a very important consideration in the United States and all over the world. Moving to slide 24, I'm not sure how familiar people are with why some of these flame retardants are in different types of products, but really there are different rules and different standards which vary depending on the product, the consumer product the one is referring to. And we're here in this presentation, we're focusing a lot on PBDEs. And most of the accumulation of PBDEs in human tissues is really from the use of a pentacommercial mixture, which was used primarily in furniture. And a lot of that use was driven by, as I stated here in the slide, California Technical Bulletin 117, which governs use in residential furniture, and 603, which refers to public buildings. And there certainly are other flammability standards governing the use of flame retardants in products, and this is certainly not an exhaustive list. It's just an example of certain standards, some that cover mattresses, some that cover electronics, some that cover some textiles, and certainly there's concerns about children's sleepwear, but maintaining fire safety standards, and even things like camping equipment, and then certainly building and construction materials. So moving to slide 25, this is just a definition of, some explanation of what this California TB117 flammability standard is. It really governs residential furniture, and it's a flammability standard focused on the polyurethane foam found inside most furniture, requiring that it will withstand a 12-second open flame test. And typically the way that most manufacturers meet this standard is by using halogenated flame retardants in the polyurethane foam in an additive manner, although some people are now using phosphate-based flame retardants, and I'll talk a little about that at the end. And even though this is technically a California standard, it's really affecting the use of flame retardants in furniture that's sold throughout the U.S. and sometimes globally, as some manufacturers don't really want to produce a product that they can only sell in one state. So moving to slide 26, these are just some pictures of some items that you might be familiar with and that are often treated with flame retardants. Certainly we measured furniture. There's things like TVs, electronics, drapes around windows. We've recently done a study looking at flame retardants in baby products, which is why you see a car seat and a nursing pillow. That pink rectangle shape is actually a picture of insulation you typically found in most homes, camping equipment, and then even some things that might seem innocuous, like some small appliances like a coffee maker or Christmas lights are also have been suggested to have flame retardants used in those products as well. Moving to slide 27. Linda mentioned that there are several different PVDE commercial mixtures, and here are the three commercial mixtures and how they are commonly referred to. Penta is, again, the one that's typically found or is known to be most accumulative in human tissues, particularly in the U.S., and was primarily used in the U.S. 98% of the global market demand for this mixture was used in the U.S., which is the primary reason why the U.S. population has higher body burdens of these compounds. And, again, it was primarily used in polyurethane foam that's typically found in furniture. It also can be found in carpet padding that's typically made from recycled polyurethane foam. As Linda said, these were phased out in 2004, the penta and the octa mixture. And within the slide, I'm showing you some of the common congeners that are found within those mixtures and the percent of the mixture that they constitute. Moving to slide 28, Linda's already mentioned a lot of this as well, but PVDEs have very similar chemical structures to chemicals we know from historical studies that are very persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic, like PCBs, dioxins, and furans. And certainly the literature already suggests that they have very similar mechanisms of toxicity, particularly related to thyroid hormone regulation and neurodevelopmental outcomes. Moving to slide 29. And again, I won't kind of reiterate many of these. Linda's already brought many of these up. The concerns that they are rapidly accumulating in the humans and the environment. Several animal studies have already noticed changes in hormone levels following exposure and controlled studies, and now we're seeing some changes being reflected in the human population as well. And there's certainly some developmental effects being noted and some slight concerns about cancer, although some of the more significant concerns seem to be focused more on thyroid hormone regulation and neurodevelopmental outcomes. Moving to slide 30, and this kind of already stated this too, but again, the trend over time is that the PBDEs have been accumulating in human tissues. And this graph here, which is basically a summary of a review by Height that was published in 2005, really demonstrates the accumulation of the PBD congeners found in that penta mixture. And what this is really demonstrating is that the red triangles represent measurements made in the U.S. and Canadian populations. And because this is on a log scale, if you notice on the y-axis, that the populations in the U.S. and Canada certainly seem to have much higher exposures and much higher body burdens than reports that have been made or measurements made in both Europe, Japan, and other Asian countries. So moving to slide 31. Just again talking now more about exposure. I'm going to be moving to some of our exposure studies, and we know that certainly diet can be an exposure route, but as Linda is saying, more and more evidence suggests that we're exposed to these compounds in indoor environments, which might be our home, but also could be in our work environment or either while we're commuting in our vehicles, because even materials in our cars are treated with flame retardants. So moving to slide 32, there's been certainly several studies looking at exposure in the general population, and initially some modeling studies suggested that infants would have the highest exposure to PBDEs due to breast milk ingestion, and then if you're looking at exposure versus age classes, that exposure might decrease for children and toddlers where they have significant exposure from dust. And then as you grow older, more of it might be coming from diet. And certainly studies have shown that the PBDE body burdens are significantly associated with both dietary intake and dust ingestion, as you can see in the second bullet. But there's been fewer studies done on children, which is one of the reasons that we have looked at exposure in children, and I'll talk about shortly. Two studies have been conducted and that were published in 2010 looking at PBDEs in children, where they certainly found that concentrations, at least in children in California, were 2 to 50 times higher than what had previously been reported in adults. And then there's now some suggestion that PBD exposure may be an environmental justice issue. because one study by Wyndham found that concentrations in young girls were higher in blacks compared to whites. And if you look at PBD levels in indoor dust from low-income households, some of the highest concentrations have been recorded. So there's been some prospective articles written on whether or not PBDEs may be a socioeconomic concern or an environmental justice issue. So moving to slide 33, I wanted to talk a little bit about the study we conducted, and we published a paper on this just last year looking at PBD levels in a pregnancy cohort. And we were really interested in trying to determine, if PBDEs were associated with some of the thyroid hormones during pregnancy because of the importance of maintaining thyroid hormone levels at a certain range during pregnancy because of they are transferred to the fetus and can influence development. We also wanted to look at whether there are any associations between PBD levels in the mom and any birth outcomes, specifically with things like birth weight and birth length. So moving to slide 34, we recruited some women into a study in Durham, North Carolina, and because of limitations on the availability of samples, we were only able to collect samples from pregnant women in the third trimester that were greater than 34 weeks into gestation, so certainly later in pregnancy. We collected two tubes of blood. One was analyzed for thyroid hormone levels at the Duke University Hospital Clinic, and my laboratory measured PBDEs and a few of the phenolic metabolites. Moving to slide 35, this just portrays the population of our cohort, which was primarily non-Hispanic black young women, primarily between the ages of 18 and 24. And these individuals were recruited between September 2008 and June 2010. Moving to slide 36. This is just representing the PBDE levels that were detected in the serum for the women in our cohort. The congeners are found on your left. And these represent the congeners that are typically found in most general populations, again with the PBDE47 being the typical dominant congener, with a geometric mean value of 16.5 nanograms per gram lipid in our population, and then BDEs 99 and 153 also being detected in the majority of the samples and having significant concentrations. We tried to measure BDE 209 in our samples, but unfortunately blank levels really prohibited that, and it's not uncommon. It's a blank contamination of 209 is found in most laboratories, unfortunately. Moving to slide 37. This just gives you an example of how the levels or the measurements in our cohort compared to the NHANES study, which is a survey of levels in the general U.S. population. And these are, the NHANES is really represents data or samples that were collected in 2003 and 2004. Again, our study, the samples were collected between 2008 and 2010. So it might appear that these levels are almost exactly the same, suggesting that the levels have actually are consistent now between 2003 to 2010. However, I might suggest that they might actually be declining. The problem with comparing my study with the NHANES is that, again, our population was primarily non-Hispanic black young women. And if you look at the NHANES data, there are certainly higher concentrations noted in younger individuals as opposed to older, and there are also higher concentrations in non-Hispanic blacks versus non-Hispanic whites. I wasn't able to pull the data out for our specific age class and race, but that has been observed. So at least the levels are at least are consistent throughout the past 4 to 8 years, or they might actually be declining. Moving to slide 38, we also monitored several of the phenolic metabolites or several compounds that are known to be metabolites of PBDEs. We looked for 1 tribromophenol and 4 hydroxylated PBDEs, and we detected 2 of the hydroxylated PBDEs and the tribromophenol in 50% or more of the samples. 2,4,6 tribromophenol is a little more, had slightly higher concentrations, but it had a lower detection frequency. And while 2,4,6 tribromophenol has been observed to be a metabolite, it is also used on its own as a flame retardant. So it's difficult to tell if that compound is formed as a result of metabolism of PBDEs or from differential exposure. And there has been some concerns about OHBDEs being detected in human tissues, but their source would be from marine sources. It has been documented that marine sponges and algae can synthesize hydroxylated BDEs. Where if we go to slide number 39, you'll see that we observed a very strong correlation between the PBDE levels in the serum and the levels of hydroxylated BDEs, suggesting to me that these are likely present due to metabolism of the PBDEs and not from a dietary exposure source. Moving to slide 40. Here you can see our data that represents the correlation between the PBD levels that were measured in the serum from these women and the measurements of here free T4. The red bars represent the normal range for thyroid hormone levels for free T4 in the general U.S. population. So what we observed is that with increasing PBDEs, we are seeing an association with increased free T4, and this was also observed for total T4. It was a slight increase, and it's certainly not increasing levels outside the normal range, but they were significantly associated. Thyroid hormone levels can certainly fluctuate during pregnancy, and from talking to other people, it seems like we don't really have a very good understanding of exactly how thyroid hormone levels change throughout pregnancy, and particularly among different races and age classes. But we have seen this observation of a significant positive association. Moving to slide 41. So we noticed that, and that was in unadjusted models, and we conducted some further modeling to look at adjusted models where we controlled for smoking status, race, age, gestational age, and those associations between PBDEs and thyroid hormones were still observed. And you can see here some of our beta coefficients, and most of the congeners, with the exception of 153, were significantly associated with T4. However, we found no associations with TSH or T3. We also did not find any associations with the phenolic metabolites, the hydroxylated PBDEs, and thyroid hormones. However, we did have a smaller sample number. I forgot to point this out before, but we only had about half of the samples for hydroxylated PBDEs. There was a suggestive relationship between total T3 and hydroxylated BDE49. It had a p-value of 0.08, and that was a negative relationship, but it was not statistically significant at the 0.05 level. So we saw this positive relationship between PBDEs and T4 in our cohort. If you move to slide 42, I kind of tried to summarize other effects that have been noted in other published research studies looking at PBDEs and thyroid hormone levels, where the top grouping is from human studies and then the bottom are from animal studies. And the very top row, I have this kind of portrayed such that each column represents increasing thyroid hormone levels, whether it be increasing TSH or T3 or T4, and how that correlates with PBDEs in the rows beneath it. So in our study, we observed increasing T4 increasing T4 levels with increasing PBDEs, and no effect with TSH. And several other studies have observed very similar trends, such for Herbstman et al. And Turk et al. They also saw increased T4 levels with increasing PBDEs. Chevrier et al., a study in 2010, which was also another pregnancy cohort, while they did not see a trend with T4, they did observe a negative trend between TSH and PBDEs. And what's interesting about this is that given the negative feedback in thyroid hormone regulation, TSH and T4 are typically found in opposite directions, because if you have high T4, it shuts down the production of TSH and vice versa. So they're often intimately linked. So having a decrease in TSH with increasing PBDEs would complement an increasing T4 with PBDEs, which is like what we observed. One study that was published by Zoda et al. Did notice an opposite trend between PBDEs and TSH. It's in one study that I've observed, at least, it seems to be opposite of some of the other human studies, and that was a smaller sample size of 25, so it's really not clear. So there seems to be some consistencies and some differences. However, what stands out the most is the difference between the trends in the human population and the animal studies. If you look at the bottom of the slide, almost all the studies that have been conducting have been conducted where the different animal models have been exposed to PBDEs have seen decreasing levels, particularly of T4, and it's believed that this may be due to competition for serum transport or binding to serum transporters, and there's other possible mechanisms as well, but in animal studies, we see a decrease in T4 with PBDEs, and in human studies, we're seeing a positive or a significant positive association between PBDEs and T4. And it's really not well understood why this is. Several hypotheses have been put forward, and one may be that some of these animal studies have been conducted at relatively high levels, such that the circulating levels might be higher. And so given the feedback with the thyroid hormone system, maybe that these higher exposures will result in a drop in T4, but at lower exposures you might have an elevation T4. So one hypothesis, I know it's some people disagree with that, and it's really not clear, but certainly needs some further study. Moving to slide 43, We are currently writing up a publication describing our observations between PBD levels in this pregnancy cohort and birth outcomes. So I don't have a lot of detailed information here, but I will give you some a summary of the observations to date. Our preliminary analysis do indicate that the serum PBDs in our pregnancy cohort are negatively associated with infant head circumference in both unadjusted and adjusted models. And this was most pronounced for, I believe it was BD-153. We are not seeing any associations with birth weight or length, although all the relationships are negative, even though they're not statistically significant. So this is somewhat complements a study that was recently published by Harley et al. In 2011, where they also observed a negative relationship between PBDEs and, in this case, birth weight in their cohort, although they did not note any relationship with head circumference. There was also a study that came out of Taiwan that noticed, with increasing PBD levels, there was a decrease in birth weight and length, although that was a very small sample number. I believe it was 20 or 25. But so now some studies are suggesting that higher PBD levels during pregnancy or maternal levels are associated with decreases in some of these or negative birth outcomes. So it's certainly very interesting, and I think will probably be followed up in future studies. Moving to slide 44, I want to touch base a little bit about a study we recently conducted looking at toddlers' exposures to flame retardants. Certainly children are spending more and more time indoors these days, and unfortunately indoor environments are often more polluted than outdoor environments. This is particularly true for a lot of persistent organic pollutants, particularly things like PBDEs and sometimes things like PAHs and perfluorinated chemicals and phthalates, where they're higher, the concentrations of these chemicals are much, much higher in dust particles than they are in soils in the outdoor environment. And toddlers in particular have a very high number of hand-to-mouth contacts. They are often putting their hands in their mouths, or they have pacifiers or toys, bottles that they'll drop on the floor and put in their mouth, thus transferring sometimes dust particles and any chemicals associated with those dust particles. So there's a lot of concerns about children's exposure to these chemicals that are found in indoor dust. Moving to slide 45, we have a paper that is currently in review where we're describing results from a study with looking at children's exposure to PBDEs. Our hypotheses were that the children between the ages of 1 and 3 would have the highest exposure to PBDEs in the world due to this hand-to-mouth contact. We hypothesized that dust would be the primary source of exposure and not diet nor breast milk. And we really wanted to look at this association with SES variables, particularly education and race and income. I'll point out that I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about our results. This is in review. Just last week we received word back from the editor request for minor revisions, so I do anticipate that this will be accepted and published in Environmental Health Perspectives within the next 1 to 2 months, so you can look for that for more detailed information than what I'm presenting here. But moving to slide 46, this is just a little description of our methods. We targeted families with children between the ages of 12 to 36 months, again, 1 to 3 years in age, residing in central North Carolina, primarily in Durham and Wake counties, recruited through some of the local pediatric clinics. And we recruited families into our study between May of 2009 and September 2010. From each family that participated in our study, we collected a blood sample from the child. We collected a hand wipe sample, which really involves just a gauze pad that, and using rubbing alcohol that wiped the entire surface area of the hand to collect the any residues that might be found on the child's hand. We also collected a dust sample from the house, from the room where the parents informed us that the child spent a majority of their time during the, being active, and we had a questionnaire to collect demographic information. The serum samples were actually analyzed by the CDC just to maintain that they were conducted in the same way that the NHANES data was reported, and our laboratory analyzed the hand wipes and dust samples. So moving to slide 47, this is kind of just some summary, some bullet points. We found PBDEs in all the serum samples. They were certainly present in all the samples. And our data suggests that the concentration in our cohort, toddler cohort, PBDEs on average are about 2 times higher than they are in the adult population if you look at samples collected over the same time frame. What was interesting is that we had paired samples of serum, hand wipes, and dust from all these children that participated in our study. And we found very significant associations between all three of those compartments. But the most significant association was in our study was between the PBDEs in the serum and the PBDEs on the hand wipes, suggesting to us that the hand wipes were actually a much more stronger predictor of serum PBDEs than the dust samples were. And again, suggesting that hand-to-mouth contact was very important. And there was also a high degree of correlation between the hand wipes and the dust, suggesting that the dust is the source to the hand wipes. We also found significant associations with SES variables, breast milk ingestion, and age. And what was interesting about the age is that we found that concentrations of the PBDEs actually increased from age 1 to age 3, whereas most models had anticipated you'd see the opposite trend because you'd have higher exposure from breast milk ingestion as an infant, and then it would decrease as infants were weaned off of breast milk, and then you had other dietary and dust exposure routes. But our study kind of suggests the opposite, because if you had higher exposure from breast milk, you'd expect a higher concentration around age 1. And we're seeing increases from 1 to 3 that seem to be associated with dust exposure. We had a negative association between PBDEs and SES variables, such that there are higher concentrations of PBDEs in serum from children that came from non-white families or families that had lower educational backgrounds. And some of the conjugates, this is primarily BD-153, was significantly associated with the duration of breast milk ingestion. And BD-153 is known to have a very long half-life in the body compared to the other PBDEs. We believe this is a reflection of the long half-life of that congener. And because we saw this association with SES, it really raises the question of why this may be an environmental justice issue. Our data did not find any SES signal in the dust samples that were collected, but they were apparent in the hand wipes and the serum samples. And we're continuing to work on the analysis of these samples to determine if we can come up with some plausible hypotheses about why this relationship with SES exists in the toddlers. So this brings up the question of what are the consequences of this exposure. So moving to slide 48, as you can see here, PBD is a very similar structure to thyroid hormones that circulate in our body. On the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see the structures for thyroid hormones, T4 and T3, and these are hormones that circulate in our bodies and are very important for controlling growth and development, particularly important for fetal development and brain development. And on the right, you'll see some hydroxylated PBDEs, and PBDEs can be metabolized by cytochrome P450s to hydroxylated forms. And here you can see by that, including this hydroxyl group on the PBDE, becomes more similar in structure to the thyroid hormones. And certainly studies have shown that the hydroxylated PBDEs are more potent at inhibiting some thyroid hormone endpoints or regulating endpoints than the parent compounds are. So moving to slide 49, I want to try to present a summary of all the different effects that have been observed, or some of the effects that have been observed related to thyroid hormone regulation. And I've taken this slide actually from most of Dr. Cotavanti's publications, but it presents a nice overview of different mechanisms that are being impacted by PBDEs and actually other organohalogens as well. If you start off in the middle of the diagram on the top, there's this cascade that controls thyroid hormone release from the thyroid, which you kind of see in the middle. The thyroid, T4 is secreted from the thyroid and enters the bloodstream. You can see the T4 in the yellow circles. OHN stands for organohalogens that might enter the bloodstream as well, and it's known that these organohalogens can compete with for binding sites on TTR, which is a serum protein transporter. That's been observed by Mirta et al. There's also some suggestion that the PBDEs can upregulate xenobiotic metabolizing enzymes, which might lead to further clearance of thyroid hormones from cells. Work in our lab has shown that the PBDEs, some other flame retardants, and particularly the hydroxylated PBDEs, can be significant inhibitors of deiodinase activity, which is represented by number 7 in the diagram. Deiodinases are very important for converting T4 to the active hormone T3, which then binds to nuclear receptors. And hydroxylated PBDEs can certainly inhibit this process. And our lab is currently looking at the inhibition of sulfotransferase activities in hepatocytes as well, where we've observed that hydroxylated PBDEs are also very potent at inhibiting sulfotransferase activity, and sulfotransferases are very important for conjugating T4s and removing them from the cell. So there's several different mechanisms that can be affected that ultimately combined can affect the levels of the thyroid hormones within the cell, and particularly the levels of T3 that are available to bind to the nuclear receptors. So moving to slide 50, this is just an overview of one of the papers we published last year, my postdoc, where we looked at the conversion of T4 to T3 in human liver microsomal samples and found that the activity of this enzyme was significantly inhibited by several different flame retardants and even triclosan. And our most potent inhibitor was 5' OHBDE99. And you can see on this figure that the blue line doesn't extend all the way down, and that's because we reached the limit of our availability for that standard, but it does suggest that it would be the most potent. Of these four here, our paper reports on several other compounds that we examined as well that were also inhibitors of the deionase activity in human liver microsomal samples. Moving to slide 51, we've shown that these compounds can inhibit deactivity in vitro, and the question is whether this would happen in vivo, and certainly we've seen this happen in fathead minnows exposed to DECA-BDE for 28 days, where we saw a 74% decrease in deactivity relative to controls. And right now we're actually exploring the impact of PBDEs on deactivity in placental tissue, because certainly deionases are very important in placental tissue for mediating the levels of T3, the thyroid hormones that reach the fetus. And studies in mice have shown that if you knock out type 3 deionase, you'll have significant fetal growth restrictions. And so we have a grant right now where we're exploring the relationships between PBDEs and deionase activity in placental tissue, and you can see from the small figure here that of a preliminary data from 20 samples has seen this negative relationship. So we're wondering if this may relate to some of the adverse birth outcomes that have been observed. So we're exploring that some more. So moving to slide 52, this is getting to wrapping up my talk. These are just some other observations that have been reported in the literature. PBDs have been shown to affect the development, differentiation, and migration, particularly of fetal human neural progenitor cells. And they found that this was effect was mediated by particularly T3, the thyroid hormone, suggesting that the PBDs are somehow interfering with the ability of the thyroid hormones to bind to the nuclear receptors. Certainly studies in rodent models have seen that exposures during critical windows of development can lead to significant alterations later in life in behavior, habituation, learning, and memory function, and also effects on expression of certain proteins in the brain, which has also been noted. Moving to slide 53, and Linda has already mentioned this study, but the study by Hirschman et al. Found that if higher PBD levels in cord blood at birth were negatively associated with developmental indices in infants and young children, so suggesting that higher levels of PBDEs at birth were associated with decrements in IQ and mental functions in some children. And certainly this was very eye-opening, and I know other research studies are trying to determine whether these observations can be replicated or not. So moving to slide 54, Linda kind of touched on the fact that, you know, while PBDs have been phased out, you know, there are still other flame retardants being used. I wanted to point out that our lab has actively been trying to identify the replacements that are being used, at least in furniture and polyurethane foam. Certainly there are some concerns about some of the replacement products, and we published a paper just last year on the flame retardants that are commonly found in infant baby products that contain polyurethane foam. If you move to slide 55, here's just some of the structures which we've identified in some of these, not only baby products, but we're now identifying them in furniture as well. Here's some of the main three flame retardants. One is known as Firemaster 550, which is sold by Chemtura. It's a mixture of halogenated and non-halogenated flame retardants. You might notice that this TBPH compound looks a lot like diethyl hexaphthalate. TDCPP on the right, chlorinated tris, was the chemical Linda was referring to that was once used in children's pajamas. And according to our studies, is actually the most common flame retardant now detected in polyurethane foam purchased within the United States, both in infant products and in furniture. So it's certainly known to be mutagenic in the Ames assay, and there's some concerns about carcinogenicity. And on the bottom, there's this chemical, which I won't even, you know, spell out that name, but it's called, commonly referred to as V6. The diphosphate, chlorinated diphosphate, and we've detected that, and there's really virtually no information on health toxicity effects or environmental levels for that compound, so certainly of interest to follow. So just in conclusion, I know I'm kind of running over time, but as I said, PBDs, exposure to PBDs certainly occurs during early development, particularly during pregnancy, and toddlers certainly seem to have an elevated exposure that increases between the ages of 1 and 3. And our study certainly suggests that hand-to-mouth contact is a very important exposure route for PBDEs in toddlers. We're observing some relationships with SES variables, and from our study in a multivariate model, both hand wipe levels, age, SES, and breast milk congestion appear to be the most significant predictors of serum PBDE levels in toddlers, and this may be an environmental justice issue that requires further study. And from several other studies, we know that PBDEs affect thyroid hormone regulation via multiple pathways, and this may be influencing these outcomes we're seeing with growth, birth outcomes, and neurodevelopmental outcomes, but certainly we need more research to understand the links between these observations and the circulating levels of PBDEs. So my next slide is really just acknowledgments. I certainly thank NIHS for funding a lot of this grant and my collaborators, and I will end there, and hopefully I think we'll turn it over to Dr. Cotavante.
Well, Heather, thank you very much. That was very good. Outstanding, very informative. Before we go on to our next presentation, I would like to take a few questions. So let's go to the phone lines first. So if you would like to ask the questions, please take your phone off of mute by pressing *7. State your name and organization, ask your question, and then you can remute your phone by pressing *6. So, we did receive a few questions that came in by email, and I'm going to ask some of these questions here, and this is, I guess, directly towards Heather. The question is, and there's no, I don't know who asked this question, but I've heard that the location of landfills is an environmental justice issue. Could this be possible, could this be a possible reason that PBDE exposure seems to be linked to low SES?
Yeah, sure. If I heard the question correctly, they're asking about the relationship between PBDEs and landfills and some of the SES observations that have been noted. So certainly there's concerns about PBDEs leaching out of landfills, and certainly people have been known to discard furniture, which could be a source of PBDEs to the landfills. And certainly the landfills are often associated or found more in low-income neighborhoods. So that might explain why if some studies are observing higher PBDE levels in the dust, it may be due to proximity to some of the landfills. However, I've not seen a really well-designed study that has looked at those relationships. The one study that I had noted in this presentation, which just looked at low-income households in some minority areas of California, but they didn't have any notation or observations to landfills. However, in our study, I will point out that we had a really good sample distribution of across SES variables, and our SES, our difference in our PBDEs was not observed in the dust samples. It was only observed in the serum and the hand wipes. So to me, that suggests it's not an issue with external sources, at least. So it's either something that the children are touching, or for some reason they have more on their hands. It could be that they are not washing their hands as frequently, or they just come into contact more with sources in their home. But at least if you look at the level of their concentrations and the dust levels, there's no difference between among the SES categories for PBDEs in the dust. So it's certainly an interesting point and probably should be investigated, but I have not seen that to be, or haven't seen those studies that have shown that to be true right now.
Thank you. If somebody wants to ask a question by phone, go ahead and do so again by...
battery in the main one. I've opened both of them, and there's no battery at all. They're hardwired.
Whoop. I don't know what that was, but that was exciting. Okay. I'm going to ask another question, and it's one that came in from David McBride at the Washington State Department of Health in Olympia, Washington. It came in during your talk, and it actually, I find it is an interesting question because even though it focuses primarily on fish advisories and age, The question is, if one looks at state fish advisory, the age given for susceptible populations to contaminants such as mercury, PCBs, PBDEs, and DDTs varies greatly. Some states use 0 to 1 year olds. Some use 0 to 3, 0 to 6, 0 to 16, 0 to 18. Really? In your opinion, is there an age cutoff or a range that should be used to cover the potentially vulnerable populations when giving, this is for the advice to fish advice to consumers, but I think it has any kind of issue regarding susceptible populations.
Yeah, so hopefully I've comprehended the question, but I mean, from my perspective, certainly the critical window that you should be more concerned about exposures to not only PBDs but some of these other contaminants is during pregnancy and young children. So I think the advisory should focus more on limiting exposure or consumption of fish for pregnant women and young children, particularly, you know, children, I would say even between not only 0 and 1 but 0 to 5, probably concerned for all age groups but most particularly during pregnancy and very young infants and children. I mean, I have a toddler at home. He hates to eat fish, so I don't think there's probably a lot of infants and toddlers eating fish, but if you're talking primarily about adults and older children, pregnancy, I think, is a very important window to limit exposure to.
Thank you. I do have one other question, and this is the question that came in during your talk, and if exposure to PBDE is primarily through dust, would a cleaning regimen be recommended for reducing exposure? You mentioned
that's a question we get a lot, and it's sometimes very difficult to answer because it sometimes might depend on what cleaning action or remedy one might suggest. Certainly, you know, limiting dust particles in your home and exposure to those dust particles is always going to be beneficial for reducing exposure to these contaminants. It's just a question of whether cleaning your home would lead to increased exposure, because sometimes if you're vacuuming or cleaning, if you're, you know, dusting around an area, you're actually resuspending some particles into the air that you might actually then end up inhaling. So you just have to be a little bit careful. Certainly cleaning the house, installing, you know, filters that would remove particles, sometimes people will think about moving from carpets to hardwoods because carpets will capture and retain more dust particles than you would on a hardwood floor where it might be easier to clean. So certainly cleaning would be recommended, anything to reduce particles. You just have to conduct your cleaning practices in such a way that you don't end up resuspending more of the dust particles that can then lead to exposure.
Great. Thank you very much. And again, thank you. We're going to then move on with our second presentation, which is by Dr. Posada Cotavante. Dr. Cotavante is a senior research toxicologist at the neurotoxicology branch of the National Health and Environmental Health Research Laboratory at EPA here in Research Triangle Park. In this role, he leads a team of scientists to develop in vitro methods based on modes of action for screening and prioritization of chemicals. In 1991, Dr. Cotavante first came to EPA in Research Triangle Park as a visiting scientist. In January of 1995, he joined the US EPA as a toxicologist in the Neurotoxicology Division. He is a well-recognized scientist in the area of persistent chemicals and developmental neurotoxicity. His current focus is on identifying molecular markers based on mode of action for the developmental neurotoxic effects of environmental chemical mixtures. Dr. Cotavante is an extremely prolific researcher. To date, he has published over 100 peer-reviewed journal articles. In addition, he is a primary author on 14 book chapters as well as 9 review articles. His publications appear in a wide variety of leading journals. In 1996, one of his papers won the prestigious Society of Toxicology's Board of Publications Award for the Best Paper in Toxicology and Applied pharmacology. He received EPA's 1996, 1999, and 2002 Scientific and Technological Achievement Award. In 2009, he received that award level one, which is the highest scientific award by EPA, for highlighting genomics in understanding modes of action of developmental neurotoxicity. Dr. Cotavanti gave several invited presentations at national and international meetings. He has also been a session chair and a member of special session organizing's committee for Dioxin 97. He is a member of the advisory board of the journals Pharmacology and Toxicology, Toxicological Sciences, and Neurotoxicology. He's been a member of an NIH study section since 1991, and he's an adjunct professor of toxicology, School of Pharmacy at the University of Rhode Island, in Kingston, Rhode Island. With that, I will turn it over to Dr. Cotavanti. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill, for the nice introduction. I want to thank Heather Henry for inviting me to give this talk. Good afternoon to everyone, and thanks to all the participants for their interest in this webinar. I'm very pleased to be a part of this webinar, along with two great scientists in this field, and happy to share some of the work that we did some time ago. Most of the work is published, so I'll be glad to email the publication if anybody is interested. First, I want to thank Linda for introducing this topic, and also Heather for giving an excellent history of the BFRs, brominated flame retardants. What I will do is, I'll briefly go over the first introductory slide and probably focus on the study that we did, the developmental exposure to D71 commercial mixture. There are several people involved in this project, so I want to recognize some of the folks. Carrie Coburn was a pre-doctoral fellow in my lab. Ginger Moser and Bob McPhail conducted neurobehavioral tests. Sue Fenton, who is now at NIEHS, did mammary gland development. Tammy Stoker and Jenny Rayner did male reproductive endpoints. Kahneman from Wadsworth Center did the analysis, conjugate-specific analysis of PBDEs. Of course, Linda is involved, extremely involved, in the planning the study and also design the experiments. My colleagues Joyce Witold and also Oscar Alzate from UNC conducted both genomic and proteomic experiments. So moving on to the next slide, which is slide 59. This is just a brief outline of talk. What I plan to do in the next 20 minutes or so, I'll try to provide some information about developmental study that we conducted. As I mentioned, Linda and Heather both covered the introductory part, so I will rush the first few slides for the sake of time, and then I'll discuss something about the environmental contamination of PBDEs, where I will discuss the human exposure, some of the structural effect similarities with other organohalogen compounds, such as polychlorinated biphenyls. So then I will focus on our results on the neurobehavioral, neurohormonal, and also reproductive effects following developmental exposure to D71. At the end, I'll take a few minutes and then tell some information about the risk assessment considerations for these compounds. So, as I mentioned, that this is already covered by Heather and also Linda, but briefly, as per the BSEF Bromine Science Federation website, BFRs are believed to save lives and property, and it's a several billion dollar industry. These are very cheap to make. It's believed that brominated flame retardants give additional time to escape from the fire. Moving on to the next slide, slide 61. Brominated flame retardants, again, these are family of 75 chemicals. There are three major classes, tetrabromobisphenol A, hexabromocyclododecane, and also polybrominated diphenyl ethers. I'm going to focus only on polybrominated diphenyl ethers in this presentation. Moving on to slide number 62. These are high production volume chemicals. There are three commercial mixtures based on number and also position of the bromines. The one we studied, D71, belongs to a pentabrominated diphenyl ether mixture. This mixture is used in foam material. 98% of the world use is in Americas. All the congeners in this mixture are bioaccumulative, and most of the congeners are found in human tissues. The next slide, where do we find these compounds? You know, as Heather and Linda pointed out, you know, so these are like, they are found everywhere. They are ubiquitous, like other persistent chemicals. One difference between the others and this is there is a lot of indoor exposure for this group of chemicals. They are both found in indoor as well as outdoor. They are found in air, house, and office dust. They are found in rivers, lake sediments, sewage sludge. You know, of course, they are found in remote, you know, they are found even in remote Arctic regions. Technically, at these places, you know, PBDs were never used, so indicating some kind of global transport of these chemicals. Of course, they are found in food and biota also. Moving on to the next slide, which is 64. What I showed here is the potash, you know, both point sources as well as non-point sources. PBDs can release from industrial effluents to surface waters, also sediments during manufacture and disposal. The second way, second point source is the wastewater treatment plants. As Heather pointed out, sewage sludge has high levels of PBDs. Probably you know that over half of the sludge produced annually in U.S. is applied to land as fertilizer. So application of sewage sludge may represent a source of exposure to humans and wildlife through direct contact or uptake by plants. The third source that I listed here is the landfills. Most of the consumer products are being sent to these landfills. PBDs are considered as additive compounds. That means they can leach out from the consumer products. So when once they are in the landfills, volatilization, also leaching, may lead to the distribution of PBDs into various environmental compartments. The next slide, which is slide 65, shows the non-point sources mostly include plastics, foam, and electronic materials. As Linda and Heather pointed out, you will be surprised that some of these compounds are as much as 30% by weight. So therefore, large quantities of these compounds can leach the environment in the form of consumer products. So this is a particularly a concern because these products do not have long half-life and are primarily discarded into landfills. So the next slide, which is slide 66, shows the human exposure scenario. It is mainly through oral exposure, either it is ingestion or through diet, inhalation. Exposure to PBDs can occur at workplaces, indoor and also outdoor air. Children are mainly exposed in utero due to maternal transfer to fetus and also through breast milk. Moving on to the next slide, slide 67, what I did is I borrowed this slide from Schechter, who analyzed, who proposed this PBD intake by U.S. population by age. One thing that he pointed is that meat products seem to contribute to a major portion of dietary intake by everyone except infants, which is showed on the solid black bar on the left side. You know, most of the contribution is through breast milk. So also I want to draw your attention to the number on top of each bar. So as you see, infants has the most exposure compared to the rest of the population. So this is one reason why we conducted developmental study with the DE71 commercial mixture. In general, you know, why do we care about the polybrominated diphenylethers? There are three reasons that I think we should be concerned about this. The first thing is these are persistent, bioaccumulative, and structurally similar to other compounds like polychlorinated biphenyls, DDT. So we know that PCBs and DDT are developmental neurotoxicants. So there is a concern there. At that time, you know, the levels of these compounds, PBDs, have been increasing rapidly. The third point is that some of the effects of these PBDs, both in animals as well as in vitro studies, they are similar to polychlorinated biphenyls on a molar basis. So here is a slide showing the structural similarities between, this is slide 69, structural similarities between PBDs with other persistent chemicals. The top left structure shows the biphenyl ring, and then top right shows the diphenyl ether ring. You can see the structural similarities. One thing that I wanted to point out is with regard to polychlorinated biphenyls, there are some congeners that can be coplanar in nature that resemble to dioxin-like, but whereas there are more congeners that are non-dioxin-like, that are more non-coplanar in nature. Whereas if you look at polybrominated diphenylethers, almost all 209 possible congeners are non-coplanar in nature. We have done extensive structure activity relationship with PCB congeners, and we have shown that non-coplanarity plays a major role in causing the development of neurotoxicity. This has been confirmed by other scientists within the USA and also in the Europe. So the next slide, slide 70, shows that the levels of the PBDs were increasing with the time. This is also a repetition, but I just want to draw your attention to the left figure, which shows the breast milk levels of PBDs in Texas population. The levels were as high as 418 nanograms per gram. So I just want you to remember that at least 5% of the population that they tested has levels as high as 400 nanograms. I'm going to bring up that issue when I talk about the risk assessment. The next slide shows that the question is, are PBDA levels approaching to the levels of PCBs? The top figure, this is slide 71. Top levels, figure shows that levels of PCBs that are decreasing with the time. The levels of PBDs were increasing with the time. But if you look at the scale, even though there are dramatically the PCBs are decreasing, the levels were still higher than those of PBDs. But this is a comparison in the Swedish population. But I just want to bring up the concentrations that we saw reported in Texas population was as high as 400 parts per billion. So the next slide, which is slide 72, shows again the levels of PBDs are approaching to the levels of PCBs in adipose tissue of Californians. So the difference is not that much. It's only 5 to 8 fold. So In the literature, as Heather showed, there are several studies demonstrating developmental neurotoxicity following exposure to PBDAs, both in mice as well as rats. Ginger Moser did several experiments in EPA using mice, and Per Eriksson's group did quite a number of studies from Sweden. All these studies demonstrated developmental neurotoxicity. Hello? The mice seems to be very sensitive compared to rats. There are several sensory and also cognitive effects. With regard to mechanism of action, there were three proposed mechanisms for PCBs. All these three mechanisms seems to work for polybrominated diphenyl ethers as well. The first one is the depression in serum thyroid hormone levels. The second one is the effects on intracellular signaling. And then the third one is the effects on neurotransmitters. One thing that I wanted to point out is the effects that Per Eriksson saw with the PBDAs were similar to the effects seen with PCBs on a molar basis. When we tested these two compounds in vitro using neuronal cells, using a neurochemical endpoint, that is formal ester binding, which indicates translocation of PKC from cytosol to the membrane, if we look at the data on the left, we compared the effects between D71 to Aerocore 1254. On a weight basis, Aerocore 1254 is more efficacious compared to D71. But that's not the case if we transform the entire data in represent on a molar basis. And where you can see the comparison between PBD47 and PCB47 on the right figure, where both PBD47 and PCB47 are equally efficacious on a molar basis, so indicating that these compounds act similarly. So now what I will do is, and I will move on to the developmental studies that we did. We selected DE71 as mentioned because this is a pentamixture, and most of these congeners that we see are in this mixture. Here is the experimental plan. This is the slide 75, okay? For dosing and testing paradigm, we have obtained pregnant dams at GD3 and kept them in our animal facility. We prepared dosing solutions in corn oil. We obtained DE71 as a gift sample from Great Lakes Chemical Corporation, and we prepared different dosing solutions. We published the congener composition and also the contaminant quantities previously. What we did is we exposed the pregnant dams by oral gavas every day between 8 and 10 a.m. from gestational day 6 through PND 21, except on day of birth. That is, we called it as PND 0. We evaluated several endpoints at different times, as shown in this figure. Neurobehavioral testing was done starting at PND 24, while proteomics work was done at PND 14. We measured thyroid hormone levels and also looked at several reproductive endpoints at different time points starting at PND 4. Moving on to slide 76. Where I showed both body weight, maternal, and also offspring. The top left panel shows maternal body weight, which showed no change. The top right panel shows offspring body weight at pre-weaning before PND 21, both males and females combined data, and we didn't see any significant change either there. But however, the lower panel, the left one shows male weights and the right one shows female weights. As you can see that there is no significant change in the weight of males But however, in the females, there is a slight decrease in the body weight gain starting from PND 29. Moving on to the next slide, slide 77. Bob McPhail and Ginger Moser did several neurobehavioral tests. This include functional observational battery. You know, these are a number of tests including motor activity and all that. They didn't see any significant behavioral abnormalities, even though they saw in mice, but they didn't see in rats. The only significant behavioral finding was a dose by age interaction in the number of rearing in an open field test. However, even though this is very subtle observation, but however, it is consistent with the reports that are there in the literature using mice. Moving on to the next slide, we did some proteomic experiments using brain tissues. What we did is, instead of doing one assay at a time, we took a global approach. We selected a cerebellum and a hippocampus because of these two regions, the demonstrated effects of motor activity and also cognition. These two brain regions have critical roles in the function of these two, in the both motor activity as well as learning and memory. So we did the proteomics in these two tissues. The slide 78 shows proteomics data from the cerebellum. What we did is, this is a two-dimensional gel electrophoresis where the proteins were labeled with the side dyes, and the decider differential analysis software was used to analysis of the protein abundant changes. We identified the proteins with the mass spec, and we confirmed these results by doing Western blots as well. Just to be brief, the results indicate there are four proteins that were differentially affected by DU71 in cerebellum. The next slide, 79, shows the proteomic data from the hippocampus. Unlike cerebellum, we saw 52 proteins that were differentially affected by DU71 exposure. The network analysis was done by Oscar Alzate at UNC. He showed that these proteins belong to energy metabolism, calcium signaling, and also nervous system growth. Now I'm going to present some data on thyroid hormone levels. The next slide is slide 80. Left panel shows T4 levels, and the right panel shows T3 levels in the dams at PND22. So it is obvious that DU71 exposure induced a significant hypothyroxemia in dams where total T4 levels were significantly lowered with no change in T3 levels. Moving on to the next slide, 81. The hypothyroxemia is not only seen in dams, but also seen in offspring. In the left panel shows T4 levels, and the right panel shows T3 levels. There is a significant drop in T4 levels in the offspring, even starting at birth, until the cessation of the exposure. That means we stopped the exposure at PND21. However, the levels return to control levels by PND 60. The next slide shows some of the male reproductive endpoints. This was done by Tammy Stoker. Top left shows anal genital distance, while top right figure shows puppeteal separation. And then the lower left shows the weights of different reproductive tissues, while lower right shows testosterone concentrations that you measured at PND 60. So the anogenital distance was measured at PND 7, what she observed is she saw a slight decrease, which is about 0.4 millimeters or 5.5% difference in the anogenital distance. Even though the decrease was small, but we think that this has biological relevance because there is no significant change in the body weight. The prepubescent separation was measured at PND 21. The delay seems to be about 1.8 days at the highest dose that we tested. The observation is also seems to be important because this was not confounded by body weight. There was no significant difference in the weights of seminal vesicles, epididymis, testis, or ventral prostate following exposure at PND 60. There was a slight decrease in serum testosterone, which is about 20%, but it was not statistically significant. The next slide, 83, shows mammary gland development. Sue Fenton examined these glands. Here, the top panel shows mammary gland development at PND4, where there is no effect for DA71 exposure. The lower panel shows mammary gland development at PND 21, where DA71 exposed female offspring displayed lack of growth in epithelial portion of the gland, fewer lateral branches, and also limited terminal end bud development. So there is a significant effect on the mammary gland development at PND 21. So Cunnan measured the next slide, which is 84. Cunnan did the analysis of PBDAs in different tissues. We measured at the top, left figure shows the levels of PBDAs in mother's milk at PND 10. And also we measured a gut contents at PND 4, and also we measured PBDAs in mammary gland at PND 22. The reason we measured at this time point is to elucidate early exposure in neonate, and also during development of brain growth development. And also we measured at PND 22 in mammary gland just to see what's the residual concentrations during post-lactation. What the results showed is we saw similar PBDA concentrations in all three measures when we represent them on a lipid basis. The continent-specific analysis seems to resemble to the to that of the 71 mixture. The right panel shows the PBDA concentrations in other tissues such as blood, liver, fat, and different parts of the brain. PBDAs were detected in all the tissues examined. The concentrations were greatest in fat tissue, followed by liver. On a wet weight basis, concentrations were in blood were more than fivefold lower than the concentrations found in brain, and about three orders of magnitude different than the amount in fat. PBD concentrations in all three brain in all brain regions were comparable; they're almost similar. But when we adjust the congener content for lipids, PBD concentrations in liver and fat were more similar, and the brain levels were generally lower than those in blood, except in striatum. When we looked at the congener-specific analysis, unlike we saw in the milk, in the tissues, the PBD-47 seems to be predominant, whereas PBD-99 seems to be depleted. That is, it doesn't resemble the DE71 commercial mixture. So in summary, what I wanted to convey is there is no dramatic effect of DE71 exposure on neurobehavior, but the proteins related to energy metabolism, calcium signaling, and growth of the nervous system were affected. D71 exposure caused severe hyperthyroxemia in moms as well as in the offspring. D71 exposure affected male reproductive endpoints. It affected mammary gland development as well. Highest concentrations were found in milk, and the PBD concentrations were comparable among brain regions, but still lower than liver and fat. So now what I want to do is, you know, the next slide shows, this one is slide 86. I want to spend a minute and talk about potential risk assessment of PBDs. This was proposed by Deb Rice from Maine. What she did is she compared the current levels of PBDs in humans with the levels of PCBs that are known to produce developmental neurotoxicity, which seems to be one of the critical endpoints for this group of chemicals. What she did is she compared the levels of PCBs to those of PBDs. The studies from Netherlands and Germany with the demonstrated adverse effects on learning, the levels of PCBs in breast milk range from 263 to 1615 nanograms per gram. If you recall, breast milk levels of in Texas women, at least in 5% of them, were as high as 400 parts per billion. So since the effects of PBDs and PCBs are similar on a molar basis, she thinks that, you know, at least 5% of the population may be at risk. But one thing that we need to remember is that these two groups of chemicals, both PCBs and as well as PBDs, they exist together, and there are some reports indicating synergistic interaction. In any case, additional research is needed to assess the risk associated with the exposure to these persistent chemicals. Moving on to the next slide, which is my last one. As I mentioned before, that we published this information. If you need any of our publication, please email me. I'll be glad to send the PDF versions. Thank you all for your attention.
Sato, thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. We're going to take a couple of minutes to ask some questions. Before we do that, I want to turn your attention to slide 88 while you're thinking about your questions, and sort of tell you about upcoming webinars on the same topic. On March 28th, we have Bob Wright and Rebecca Fry coming in to look at metals and metal mixtures in session 2. In session 3, on April 2nd, we have Ann Ashengrau and Rita La Caruso and John Meeker talking about PCEs and phthalates. Sign up early. I would also like to, on slide 89, I want to bring your attention to the fact that besides the people who are going to be in sessions 2 and 3, who are supported by NIEH's Superfund research program, as well as Heather Stapleton today, the following individuals are also supported by this program at various universities throughout the United States, doing some significant studies on a variety of agents, all looking at early life exposures to researchers. And I'm just going to hold it right there and open it up to the phone lines. If you'd like to ask a question, take your phone off of mute, again, by pressing *7. State your name and organization, ask your question, and remute your phone by pressing *6. Don't be shy. There were some questions that came in electronically, and we can go to those questions, but I'd like to, you know, while we're waiting for people to chime in from the phone lines,
let me go ahead and ask a question that came in from Musa Vegajiri from URS Corporation, Oakland, California. And the question is, what are some possible sources and mechanisms of transfer that may lead to higher DTE levels in low-income households and African-American households? I'd ask Dr. Cotavanti or Dr. Stapleton to try to answer these questions. Again, you folks have to press star 7 in order to unmute.
Can I start?
Sure.
Okay. You know, if it is for low-income people, you know, one thing that I would like to point out is probably the exposure could be the food, because for low-income people, I don't know how much they can afford to buy these electronics. You know, I mean, talking about computers and you know, other electronic devices. The exposure could be through diet. That's my take on it. I'm pretty sure that if Linda is on the line, she may be the best person too.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello. Hello, my name is Koshi, UMDNJ School of Public Health.
Right.
I had a question. Has the Toxic Substance Control Act, TSCA, has there been any additions or any comments on including some of the products as part of TSCA and in regulations and regulating it?
I'm from Office of Research and Development. I'm not in the Toxic Office. I'm not sure I can answer that, but I don't think it is in TSCA now.
Well, when you say products, I'm assuming you're referring to the commercial products, and because there is that voluntary agreement reached with the EPA and the manufacturers, it basically kind of preempted any involvement by TSCA, to my knowledge.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking back to, you know, in your presentation you mentioned about PCBs, and there is a section in there that prohibits, you know, there's the whole section on prohibiting, I mean, we're going back 20, 30 years, but, you know, this is something that's going forward. I was just wondering if any interpretive letters or anything have been put out about it.
Well, there's the significant new use rule, I know, which I guess the EPA refers to as SNR, states that if any manufacturers are importing it in any of their products, they have to make the EPA aware of it. So that's the only regulation I'm familiar with that relates to PBDEs by the EPA, unless, Prasada, you know anything else.
I think what you said is exactly correct, you know, because since they're voluntarily withdrawing these compounds, you know, there's no proposed regulation for that.
Right, and I guess then for you mentioned the imports before, I think, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do we have any other questions from the phone lines? There's a question. Oops, I'm looking at that last one. The last one. There we go. This is came in from an individual, PH2M Hill in Orlando, Florida. Are there EPA-approved methods to analyze these compounds in environmental media?
There are definitely EPA methods for measuring PBDEs and different matrices. I think EPA method 1614, I want to say, is one of them. I think that might be for sediments. But there are several others. I just don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yes, there are methods.
Okay. I'm assuming that the methods are probably available somewhere on EPA's website.
Yes. Yes, they certainly should be.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Please identify yourself.
This is Karen DiBiasio with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control.
Thank you.
And my question is for Heather. And it is, I was wondering if you have evaluated or plan to include in your evaluation the age of the consumer product, for example, furniture, et cetera, with respect to the PDDE concentrations, since more degradation, older products, may be common in lower socioeconomical homes.
Right. So I'm not sure if you're referring to our studies where we're actually recruiting families, like the children's exposure study, or if you're talking about our studies like the baby product study where we're actually measuring flame retardants in consumer products. But, you know, with the research studies where we recruit families and look at exposure in toddlers, for example, most families do not want us taking little pieces of foam out of their furniture. So we can't get any idea exactly of if there are PBDEs in their furniture or what the levels are. But I can tell you from some of our other studies where we're currently evaluating flame retardants in products that have been purchased recently and as much as 10 years ago, because there's some people that have sent us in pieces of their furniture and we've analyzed it. And we tried to look at time trends. It's harder for PBDs because there's fewer of those samples out right now. We try to look at it for some of the newer flame retardants. And it's really difficult to evaluate because, in my opinion, you're getting very different levels of the flame retardants and products depending on the foam manufacturer. You're also probably getting differences in concentrations depending on the barriers and the upholstery present on the furniture, and also due to differences in activity depending on how well worn or used the furniture is could affect the off-gassing and leaching of those flame retardants from the products. So it would be very, very difficult to evaluate temporal trends of flame retardants in consumer products because of those three factors.
What I was thinking is, as part of the survey, to just inquire as to the age of the furniture. For example, if a home has a 20-year-old couch, it's probably more degraded and more likely to be shedding dust.
It could be. I mean, I've known one or two people that have tried to evaluate that, and they can't see a trend. But because, I mean, the problem is you're never going to know if that couch has PBDEs or chlorinated tris or something else in it. If it's 20 years old, it might have PBDEs, but it might not, or it might have chlorinated tris.
Right.
So it's really difficult to run those kind of studies and see any trend. You'd also have to, as I said, it could depend on the upholstery, and it could depend on the level of activity that furniture has received.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there any other callers? If not, I have a question. Well, there's a question that actually came in from Melanie Marty from Cali, PA, in Oakland. The question is this: how can we get a better handle on emerging flame retardants? And it goes on a little bit, and let me explain where she's coming from. California recently listed one, Chlorotris TDCPP, under Proposition 65 as a carcinogen. But there are many others with very limited information on standard toxicity tests. How can we use some of the newer toxicity approaches to address some of these sooner? That's good question.
I mean, I'll respond, and I don't mean to preempt you, Prasada, but it's very difficult. I mean, the primary reason is that, you know, it's very difficult to determine who's using what in consumer products. I mean, a lot of these mixtures that are now being used as flame retardants are proprietary. I think the only information that we're really getting about what chemicals are found in consumer products are from studies like mine and others, where you're actually measuring consumer products to figure out what chemicals are present. Because there is not a lot of data on what chemicals are being used in what applications or which different types of products or what the levels are, it becomes impossible. And there's really no good, you know, data set to identify what the flame retardants are that are used in highest volumes and, you know, design a study to evaluate their toxicity. A lot of them have different structures. We have some halogenated, we have some phosphate ones, and they could all have different endpoints. So then it's a matter of figuring out which chemicals are out there, what's known about them, what's not, and trying to anticipate what the target toxicities would be. So it's very complicated, and it kind of just highlights how there really probably needs to be some changes made in chemical management in the United States, in my opinion. But I'm not sure if you want to add anything, Prasada.
The one thing that we had to be thinking is about the structural similarities between these compounds, you know. And also, if they're persistent type of thing, you know. Most of the new flame retardants, it's my understanding, they're they're not persistent per se, you know, compared to the highly persistent halogenated, you know, the compounds like PVDs and PCBs.
So, not that I'm totally disagreeing with you, but I'd be careful in how we say what's persistent and what's not, because
you know,
a lot of the
relative.
It is relative, but also most of the persistence measurements are based on persistence in air, water, or soils or sediments. And for a lot of the flame retardants, they accumulate in indoor dust, and their persistence in indoor dust could be significantly longer than it's going to be in water, air, or soil or sediment. So, I mean, in that regard, I think if someone evaluated persistence in indoor dust under realistic conditions, it might meet the required criteria for persistence for some of these new flame retardants.
Yep, I agree.
Just something to point out, yeah.
I have a question here.
Okay.
This is Swati Day from Procter & Gamble. This is a follow-up question on whether there are any regulations for the PVDs. And I'm looking at slide 14. Where there's a chart that says that Europe, it's been banned, all the PVDs have been banned in Europe, and U.S. soon to follow. So is that something, I mean, we should be looking out for? Because I think the previous answer to the question was a little bit, it confused me that if you're saying the U.S. is soon going to follow banning PVDs, so should we be looking out for something like that?
There's no federal ban on the PVDEs in the U.S., and I doubt there will be.
But this, in slide 14, if you can go back.
Yeah, I have it in front of me. I know.
Right.
There's a voluntary phase-out in the U.S. that's effective, and several states within the United States have prohibitively banned them. So by the several states taking action, that effectively forces the manufacturers to stop using them, typically. But there's no federal ban.
Okay.
And I don't think there will be, unless, I don't know, Prasad, I'll let you speak.
No, I agree. You know, right now there is no federal ban. The reason is, you know, if the industry voluntarily withdraws the production, you know, then there is no ban, you know. But the state can regulate these chemicals. As Linda pointed out, you know, the both Penta and Octa, they already, you know, stopped manufacturing, you know, like, but whereas Deca, I think they're going to be stop manufacturing in 2013. That's what it is. That's the increment.
So, okay. We're going to stop at this point. We're a little bit over time. First of all, I want to thank our speakers this afternoon, Dr. Birnbaum and Heather Stapleton and Dr. Cotavante, for their time and their sharing of their presentation with us today. I would like to also thank the people that are on slide 90, I think it is, especially our colleagues at EPA and ATSDR. I will mention that if you go quickly to slide 91, we have, we would ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments so that we can improve the content and delivery. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide, as I mentioned, and you can find this later on. Again, I'd like to thank everybody. We really do value your input, and thank you for working with our staff here on this. The Risky Learning Seminar Series is a vital arm of communication and research translation for the Superfund Research Program. And again, I thank everybody for participating and attending. This concludes our presentations, and thank you again. Bye-bye now.